I want to start today by talking about the thyroid some more. Last time we talked about the hypothalamic pituitary axis in general and the thyroid in particular, and the idea in this handout, this diagram is on 22C, that the you have the hypothalamus, you have the anterior pituitary, and you have the thyroid, and then you have target tissues. And that the hypothalamus releases a releasing hormone, which in this case is usually abbreviated TRH. And then in response, the anterior pituitary releases a tropic hormone, or stimulating hormone, which in this case is usually called TSH. And then the thyroid itself secretes a hormone, which is usually called TH. Now, all of these have other names, which are explained in your texts and in your notes. Now, the thyroid hormone, a.k.a. thyroxin, has effects on many different tissues. And so the level of thyroxin is itself regulated. It is a regulated variable. And that's why you have the negative feedback from thyroxin to the anterior pituitary and then to a lesser extent to the hypothalamus. If your thyroid hormone level gets too high, it's pretty obvious what happens. You're going to have negative feedback, so you're going to make less TRH, less response to it, less TSH, less stimulation of thyroid, and less TH. Now, what happens when this messes up? One of the most common problems until recently was goiter. A goiter is a swelling of the thyroid. It can get to extreme proportions. There's a picture of an extreme case in the in Sadava. And what is happening there is there's too much stimulation of the thyroid. Because TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, stimulates all those steps on the right side of your handout, all the steps involved in making thyroid hormone, including growth of the thyroid follicle. So in the absence of negative feedback, it's sort of obvious what will happen. You'll keep on piling on the TRH, you'll keep making TSH, and you'll keep stimulating the thyroid to grow. But if it doesn't make thyroid hormone, the process doesn't stop. Now, the most common cause of this is low iodine. In parts of the world where there is no iodine, goiter is extremely common. And this kind of goiter is due to low thyroid hormone. It's hypothyroid. So there's not enough thyroid hormone to stimulate the target cells. And in addition, there's not enough to prevent production of TSH and stimulation. Now, what do you do about this? Long term, you put iodine in the salt. But what do you do in the short term if someone presents with this? The problem is no negative feedback because there's no thyroid hormone. So if either because of a lack of iodine or some other reason there's no thyroid hormone, if you provide thyroid hormone, then that will inhibit further production of TRH and TSH and stop further enlargement of the thyroid. Of course, you don't want to act too much or the person will become hyperthyroid. Now, it turns out that some people who have a goiter actually have plenty of thyroid hormone. And that's called hyperthyroid. When you have too much, hyperthyroid goiter, how is that possible? How can you have thyroid hormone and still get a goiter? Well, you can see what causes a goiter or growth of the thyroid is too much TSH. So even if you have plenty of thyroid hormone, you still have too much TSH. Now, that can happen if you have a lack of negative feedback. If something is wrong with the feedback mechanism, that'll do it. You can also have a tumor that produces either TRH or TSH in extraordinary amounts. But the most common cause of having both thyroid hormone and high levels of and a goiter is a little bit different. This is called Graves' disease. And at one time, I believe the vice president, the vice president's wife, and the vice president's dog all had Graves' disease. It's actually not all that rare. And it's an autoimmune disease in which the body makes antibody to TSH. Now, normally when you make an antibody to something, it combines with that something and puts it out of commission. It inactivates the thing to which it binds. But in this particular case, the antibody to TSH activates it. So this antibody binds, this is an antibody, I said it wrong, not to TSH, but to the TSH receptor. So this antibody does not clog the receptor. Instead, it activates the receptor. So is it an antagonist or an agonist?
Agonist.
It's an agonist. It acts as an agonist of the receptor. So irrespective of the level of thyroid hormone, you have this antibody coming from the side and activating this receptor and stimulating the thyroid in the absence of the normal stimulating material. So if you have enough thyroid hormone, you don't make TSH, but the antibody stimulates the thyroid, and you can get a goiter. You also have very high levels of thyroid hormone. Now, if you don't have enough thyroid hormone, you can provide synthetic thyroid hormone. If a person has too much, what do you do? Now, this actually happened to me. I was hyperthyroid. And the way I found out is I lost weight without trying for the first time in my life. And I was very reluctant to go to the doctor. But I know something was wrong, and I went, and sure enough, I was hyperthyroid. So what they do when you're hyperthyroid, I did not have Graves' disease, it was a different cause. What they actually do is they get rid of your thyroid. Either by surgery or by giving you radioactive iodine, they disable your thyroid. And then they give you synthetic thyroid hormone for the rest of your life, which turns out to be fairly common. A large proportion of the adults I know are taking thyroid hormone, either because they didn't have enough or they had too much and they zapped their thyroids. Okay. So one of the things to realize here is the difference here between thyroid hormone, say, and insulin. Is the level of insulin regulated? Well, the level of insulin is adjusted. It's controlled. But is it a regulated variable? And the answer here is no. The insulin varies as needed to keep the glucose, the regulated variable in your blood, under control. But the insulin can go all over the place. On the other hand, thyroid hormone itself, the level of thyroid hormone is regulated because it controls levels of metabolism and other things in many, many cell types and has to be kept about right. Now, this is what I wanted to say about the thyroid, but before I go on, let me ask what questions there are before we switch gears and talk about something else. Yeah?
I had a question about the tyrosine synthesis from last month.
Mm-hmm.
The two tyrosines connected together? What is it in addition to the two tyrosines connected together that gets released? Is it just the two tyrosines with the iodine?
Her question is, what really is thyroid hormone? How does it get released? And if you look at the top of your handout, you can see that you have a picture that looks like this. It looks like this. There's just a line here, and that's meant to represent a peptide chain of thyroglobulin. And then you have the doubly modified tyrosine. Now, what happens is, in the lysosomes, this compound, the peptide bonds of this protein, are broken. And so when the peptide bonds are broken, what you release is the standard amino acid grouping, but the side chain is now modified so that it's T4 instead of tyrosine. So this is T4 thyroid hormone, or thyroxine. Yeah?
Do they know the origin of where the antibody comes from and why it sort of just appears in the middle of some...
I don't think people... His question is, why do you make antibody to this particular thing? I don't know why. I don't think it's known.
And how come the treatment doesn't involve like invalidating that antibody?
Why doesn't the treatment consist of invalidating antibody? Because invalidating antibody is not a picnic. It's very difficult to specifically inactivate one of your antibodies without screwing them all up. And so it's simpler in this case to eliminate the thyroid function and replace thyroid hormone than to deal with the antibody. There may be some known causes for this condition, but there is no one universal cause for it. Okay. Now, I want to switch gears considerably and talk for the rest of today about the kidney. Now, this is really an example of a topic in physiology of how some complicated organ works. And one of the reasons for talking about the kidney is that it uses many, many of the processes which we have been discussing, transport, signaling, etc. And so we're going to see how you put all of these things together, all these things at the molecular level, to get something important done and to maintain homeostasis. Now, the kidney is in charge of homeostasis for certain materials in your blood, keeping certain body fluids in general within certain ranges in terms of their composition, both of certain ions, certain materials, and in terms of water. Now, we tend to think of the kidney as being in charge of what goes out in the urine, which is true. It does determine that. But what goes out in the urine is not the point, just like the amount of insulin is not the point. What goes out in the urine is what you don't need or don't want. And the important part is to keep what you need and get rid of the stuff you don't. And whatever you don't happens to be in your urine. So in order to do that, the kidney carries out four processes. And let me just list them, and then we'll see what they are and how they work. And they are filtration, tubular secretion, tubular reabsorption, and control of the water volume. Now, one way of thinking about this is that the kidney is composed of multiple little tubes acting in parallel. So I brought back my tube model. The point being that it's an empty tube, but it's surrounded by a layer of cells. And if this reminds you of the GI tract, it should. It's a very similar setup. It's an epithelium wrapped around a lumen or space. So you have this basic tube, and each individual tube is called a tubule. And your kidney contains many of them. We will talk about the structure in a minute, but I think it's easier to talk about the processes first, and then the structure and where they fit in. So you have this basic tubule, and filtration is the phenomenon of determining what liquid with its contents gets into the tubule. And then secretion and reabsorption have to do with what do you take out of the tubule, what do you put into the tubule. Now, these names are sort of ambiguous. Does tubular secretion mean from the tubule or into the tubule? It would probably be clearer if it was called tubular cell secretion. This is secretion by the cells surrounding the tubule. So this means into the tubule. So tubular secretion means that these cells released it into the tubule contents. And tubular reabsorption means from the tubule. As we'll explain, there are capillaries out here. They supply materials to the cell, which then secrete selected things to be gotten rid of into the tubule. Things that are to be reclaimed are picked up by the cells, sent to the capillaries, and carried back to the rest of the body. Now, once the basic, these first three basic processes have been done, then at the end, there is control of the liquid. So these, the filtration just puts liquid into the tube. Then secretion and reabsorption adjust the supply of solutes in the tube. And then at the end, some water is taken out there, but it's not regulated. And then at the end, you have a dilute solution, and whether that just goes out at urine or you keep some of that water, that's controlled by the kidney also. So this is the basic setup. And in order for this to work, not only do you need this tubule, but you need those capillaries I was talking about. And these capillaries are actually a little different than ordinary. So let me explain how that goes. That you have an artery which subdivides into smaller arterioles. And then these branch into capillaries. This is the first set of capillaries. And then you have a little more stretch, and then another set of capillaries. And that feeds in to a venule. Now, this second set of capillaries is your standard kind of capillary, meaning that you have exchange between the contents of the capillary and the surrounding interstitial fluid and cells. Stuff moves in to be carried away. Stuff moves out to feed the cells. And these are called peritubular because they actually surround the tube. So they're around here. They're surrounding the tube, and they are supplying materials in to the cells here and taking material away. But this first set of capillaries is really quite different from your ordinary kind. That's called glomerular capillaries. These are responsible for filtration. So filtration happens here, and secretion reabsorption with the peritubular ones. So that traffic is two-way in the peritubular capillaries. Things go in, things go out. But it's one-way at the glomerular capillaries because material is being, this is actually acting like a filtration device, and material is being pushed out into the tubule. Some material continues through the bloodstream, and a certain proportion is pushed through into the tubule. So this is unidirectional filtration device. Now, some of this may be clearer if you look at your handout. If you look at A on the top left. Because that shows you the picture. It gives you some idea of what things look like. Yeah. So this is the top of the tubule. And there are cells here all along, but we've been left off for simplicity. But this is your basic tubule. And then here is the first arteriole. This one is called the afferent because it's coming in. From the point of view of the kidney, this one is coming in. And then you have the first set of capillaries in here. And it's perhaps better to draw them that way than in the usual branched way. And then you have the second set of capillaries are actually over here. It's just drawn as a single line on your handout. So this is the glomerular capillaries, and these are the peritubular ones. So the filtration takes place right here. And that's why it says GF on your handout. But what about reabsorption and secretion? Where are they? So reabsorption, remember, means into or out of the tubule. It's from your body's point of view. So what does reabsorption mean? I keep it. I take it back. So that means that reabsorption or tubular reabsorption is this way. And tubular secretion is the opposite. And then at the end of this process, we're going to do the water adjustments. We're not going to talk about that yet. So now I think it makes sense to look at each of these processes in a little more detail now that we have the basic setup. But maybe I should ask first if there are questions about this setup first. Yeah?
So then if there are, I guess, ions that don't get filtered, do they then go into secretion? Like, I don't understand what kind of secretion is that?
Okay, hold on with that one. Yeah?
So that's supplying the nutrient. You said the capillary bed on the right is supplying nutrients and removing waste. So doesn't there have to be capillaries that supply nutrients and waste?
Some of the material, there are cells here which we have not shown, and they also get material from the capillaries and supply stuff to the capillaries.
There's really two kinds of capillaries there, one kind of capillary.
Well, he's saying two kinds of capillaries. I would say no. I would say there's a whole network of capillaries around here, and it is supplying material to these cells and carrying material away from these cells. And some of that material is just the regular waste and metabolism of the cell itself, and some of it is the stuff that it pulled out of the tubule or put into the tubule. So it's the same cells and the same capillaries. Now, the sort of question of where all the ions, et cetera. So let's first look at the filtration business. So filtration occurs in this first set of capillaries. And of the liquid in the blood, that is the plasma, about 20% is pushed into the tubule or filtered. Now, the filter is such, consisting of membranes, et cetera. If you want to know about the structure, you can look at it, but we're just letting it go for now. The filter is such that cells do not get in to the filtrate. The liquid in here is called the filtrate before anything happens to it. Now, the filtrate is modified as it goes through, courtesy of reabsorption and secretion. But the initial filtrate represents 20% of the volume of the plasma. It has no cells in it and no big proteins. Now, it will have sugars, ions, small molecules, yes, but no respectable proteins and no cells. Now, the rest of the blood is going to go through various parts of the circulatory system, but some of it is going to go into the capillaries, which are responsible for exchange. Now comes this business of reabsorption and secretion is going to alter the content of small molecules in the filtrate. So if we start with secretion, it means that material from the capillaries reach these cells, and these cells specifically secreted it or released it using some sort of transport mechanism into the filtrate, or pre-urine if you want, at this time. Now, what gets secreted is some ions, potassium, for example, is secreted specifically if you have too much of it. Many toxins and drugs are secreted. Now, in some cases, this is bad news because you spend all that money to take all the drug and most of it just leaves in your urine. But for some drugs, that's an advantage. The drugs that are used to treat urinary infections, this is exactly what you would like. You swallow the drug and most of it ends up in your urinary tract where it has an effect. Okay. Now, there's the term secretion and the term excretion. They're not the same. secretion means that a specific cell releases a specific component using some sort of transport mechanism or fusion, exocytosis of vesicles or something of that sort. Excretion refers to the stuff that is released in your waste products, in your urine or feces. So there's a big difference between secretion and excretion. Now, some things that are secreted by the tubular cells are excreted. But not everything that's excreted was secreted. Now, some things are specifically reabsorbed into the body. Some things are specifically secreted into the filtrate. And some things, neither. If they're filtered, out they go. If they're not filtered, they stay. That's it. But many things are subject to one or the other. Now, what about the reabsorption part? This turns out to be very important. Because if this is 20% of their plasma, it means that there's sugars in there, there's ions in there you might need, and there is amino acids in there and other small molecules. There's all kinds of metabolites in that blood that, in fact, the body needs. And so the reabsorption is almost complete for things like amino acids, sugars. They are almost completely reabsorbed under normal conditions, meaning that there are transporters for them in the appropriate membranes. A sign of a problem is when your urine contains either sugar or amino acids, it means that there's a problem with this reabsorption, and if it contains proteins, there's a problem with filtration. Because none of these should be in your urine. Now, at this point, certain ions are reabsorbed in certain parts of the kidney. And this process, like the recovery of amino acids, is not really controlled. Whatever, it just depends on what's there. Virtually all the amino acids are recovered in a normal person. A certain percentage of the salt is recovered in a normal person. However much there is, a certain percentage is recovered. But at the very end of the tubule, there is an adjustment of recovery of the very last bit of salt is variable. It's actually regulated by a hormone of that last bit of salt, how much of it to keep and how much of it to let go. So there are actually two hormones that work at the end of this process. And they are aldosterone and ADH. Aldosterone primarily controls how much potassium is secreted and how much sodium is reabsorbed. We're going to ignore the potassium part and concentrate on the sodium, although the potassium is important. ADH, on the other hand, controls how much water is recovered and how much leaves in the urine. And we will come back to how these work in a bit. Now, I think some of the questions that people have about the cell part are answered by looking at the bottom half of your handout. This picture shows you what happens where, but it doesn't have any cells in it. Now, on the left part of your handout, it makes it clear on the bottom that there are cells here lining the tubule, just like there are cells lining this. So what they're talking about is if you made a cross-section through here, you would see a line of cells here and a line of cells there. So now what they're doing is they're blowing up. Maybe I use colored chalk, it'll be clearer. They're blowing up a little section and showing it to you on the side. So what they're blowing up is this. And now if you look on the bottom half of your handout, you see the blow up. Now, here are the cells lining the tubule. Now, it's customary to draw it this way, but this should look very familiar. If I draw the cells lining the GI tract, they would look like these cells, and this would be the lumen. So here, this is the lumen of the kidney tubule, and because of the way people think about these things, they tend to draw the kidney tubule up and down and the GI tract sideways, but same thing. So this is the lumen in here, or the middle of the tubule. And there are two sets of cells, of course, lining on either side. Now, notice that in this picture, we haven't drawn what's on the other side of the left cells. We've only drawn what's on the other side of the right cells to keep the picture simple. But the same thing is found on both sides. So the filtrate here is in the middle, and then you have these cells, and again, they're joined by tight junctions. And then you have the interstitial fluid on the other side, and then the capillary. And of course, the capillary cells are not tightly joined. So how does reabsorption work? Material has to go across the apical or luminal membrane, that's labeled 1. It has to go across the basolateral membrane, that's labeled 2. It has to diffuse whatever it is. This could be sugar, this could be amino acid, this could be an ion. It has to diffuse across the interstitial space, and then it has to enter the capillary. Now, they drew the capillaries sort of like this. And I think they should have drawn arrow 5 actually going in the space between the loosely joined capillaries. Because things get into the capillary usually by diffusion through the liquid between in the holes between the cells. So this is 1, 2, 3. What am I missing? 1. Oh. I left out 2, 3, 4, 5. What I forgot to put in is not only must the material cross the apical membrane, it must go across the cell, and then out the basolateral membrane, and then across the interstitial fluid, and then into the capillary. Now, secretion, of course, is exactly the reverse. The stuff goes out of the capillary, into the interstitial fluid, across the basolateral membrane, through the cell, and out through the luminal membrane. Now, this is just the general picture for secretion or reabsorption. What's a specific case? And there's a specific case actually shown in your handout on the upper right. Now, the upper right picture, again, is a blow-up of only part of it. This time, all they've shown you is this part. So they're only showing you the epithelial cell, the interstitial fluid, and the capillary. Now, the example that is given here on the upper right is how you reabsorb sodium. This does not happen in all of the cells lining the tubule, but it does happen in certain parts of the tubule very effectively. Now, just about every cell in the tubule, almost every cell, has down here on the basolateral surface what we've called the sodium-potassium pump. They call it basolateral sodium-potassium ATPase end carrier because, first of all, it's on the basolateral. It's an ATPase because in order for it to work, you have to break ATP. And it's a carrier because, as we now know, it takes potassium in and sodium out. Now, notice this is exactly the same as with the GI tract. At the bottom, you have a pump keeping the sodium inside the cell low and the potassium high. Now, how is that relevant to sodium transport? If the sodium is pumped out of the cell, what will happen to it? It will diffuse across the interstitial fluid into the capillary and be carried away by the capillary. Since the capillary is constantly carrying sodium away, the sodium in the interstitial fluid is low. And so we're constantly removing the sodium, allowing the pump to continue. Now, how does the sodium get into the cell? Sodium gets out. What kind of transport is this? Is it active or passive? Primary or secondary? This is primary active transport because you're splitting ATP to push the ions around. So this is primary active transport. But so we have to get the sodium into the cell. If we get the sodium into the cell, then it will be pumped out, go to the capillary, and carried away. And as you can see on your picture, all that requires is a channel. Because the sodium in the filtrate is higher than the sodium inside the cell, there is a sodium gradient across, which is favorable, so that if you open a channel, sodium will flow down its gradient into the cell. Is this active or passive? This is passive transport. But it only works because you have a sodium gradient, courtesy active transport. Now, all of the cells that remove sodium work, sodium by itself work in this way. Some of them use sodium for co-transport, which is a little different. But if they're just plain moving sodium, this is how they do it. Now, you may remember we said that some parts of the tubule secrete potassium. This is reabsorbing sodium. How do I have to change this process in order to allow to secrete potassium instead? I want you to stop and think about this for a minute and maybe discuss it. What can I do to this to allow this cell, these cells, to secrete potassium instead of reabsorbing sodium? What channels, transporters, whatever, do I have to change? With one thing. Is there something you can add that will do it? Any suggestions? Yeah?
Potassium channel.
Where would you put the potassium channel?
On the apical membrane.
So she says if we put an apical, that would be here. If we put a potassium channel, that will lead to potassium secretion. Does that sound right? Where will the potassium come from? Well, remember, the pump is putting potassium in here, and it's getting it essentially from the capillary. So potassium is being pulled out of the capillary across the interstitial fluid and pumped into the cell, and now if you open a channel here, potassium, if it's higher in the cell than it is outside, potassium will flow down its gradient outside. Now, why is it that in some parts of the tubule, potassium is secreted, and in others, sodium is reabsorbed? I'm not asking you for the teleology, for the rationale as why this makes sense. I'm asking you what's the mechanism. In the parts of the cell where potassium is secreted, what have you got? Potassium channels. And the parts where potassium is not secreted, there are no potassium channels. So the potassium is stuck in the cell, courtesy of the pump. Similarly, if there are sodium channels, sodium will flow in. If there are potassium channels, potassium will flow out given the appropriate gradients. Now, as we will see as you go down the tubule, the primary thing that changes are the transport mechanisms in the luminal or apical membrane. There is some variation in the rest of it, but that's most of it. Most of the variation is what you move across this membrane. Now, we've already alluded to the two hormones that influence events at the end of the tubule. And we could talk about this at any time, but I think since we have this picture up here, it's a good time to do it. We already said that aldosterone affects sodium reabsorption. By the time the filtrate gets to the end of the tubule, most of the sodium has been reabsorbed, but there is a small amount left. In the cells at the end, aldosterone influences this process. Virtually every step in here is affected by aldosterone. If you have aldosterone, you get more channels, more pumping, etc., and more sodium leaves. Now, it isn't a very large percent of the sodium, but remember, the liquid goes around and around and around and around and around all day. And so the total result of picking up that last little bit of sodium can make a big difference in how much sodium you have. It turns out that if you have maximum aldosterone versus zero, there's a difference of 20 grams of sodium per day. I don't actually know whether that's sodium or sodium chloride, but the point is it's a big number. If you have no aldosterone, all of that will be lost. If you have maximum aldosterone, all of that can be kept. And that can make a big difference because water follows sodium. Why does your body care about sodium? Well, of course, there's the problem of you have to have an inequality across the membrane so you can generate a resting membrane potential and action potentials and all that. And in addition, since water follows sodium, if you have too much sodium in the body, you have too much water. So you have elevated blood pressure and sometimes edema. Elevated blood pressure is because you have too much liquid in the circulatory system. Edema is when you have too much liquid in the spaces between your cells. So this, up until this point, removal of sodium was not regulated. But at this point, it is. So aldosterone is produced in response to need for reclaiming sodium. More aldosterone, you reclaim more. Less aldosterone, you reclaim less. Now, exactly what triggers aldosterone is something to which we will return. Now, we've talked a lot about ADH, so I would like to put that into the picture at this point. ADH acts at the end of this process for the fourth thing, to control overall the amount of water directly. Not sodium and let the water follow it, but water directly. Now, you probably already know that if these are the cells lining the tubule, so here comes the liquid in at the end of the tubule. If we're going to get water out of the tubule, water is going to have to be reabsorbed. It's going to have to cross the apical membrane and the basolateral membrane and be restored. Now, cells have water channels on their basolateral surface. And these apparently are constituted. Cells also contain water channels which can be inserted into the membrane or removed the way GLUT4 can be inserted or removed. Meaning that the cells have water channels which are sitting around in vesicles. in response to the right stimulus, what happens is there's fusion of the vesicle with the plasma membrane. And so now what happens, I should draw it this way. Now what happens is the water channel that used to be inside the cell in a membrane, in a vesicle, is now part of the plasma membrane. And of course, there's still water channels back here anyway. So I'll draw the other one too. Now, which of these is the case with ADH? Think about that. Discuss that one for a minute, and then we'll take a vote. Which of these cases is with ADH? Okay, I think it's time to take a vote. All right, no cheating, so close your eyes. Okay? How many people vote for one? Come on, don't be shy. One is, well, you can open your eyes for a minute, put your hands down, open your minds and look as to which is which. Make up your mind, which is whether it's one or two, okay? All right, now close your eyes. How many people think it's one? Yeah? How many people think it's two? Okay, you can open your eyes. You are divided in opinion. Okay, there's a little more on one side than the other, but this is by no means unanimous. Okay, so let's think this one through. What does ADH mean? What does the name mean? Does it mean lots of urine or not too much? Not too much. So it means reabsorption or let it go? It must be reabsorption. So that means, which one is more reabsorption? It's actually this one. Now, the fact that there's a sort of anti and this one involves fusion, but it's anti-diuretic hormone. So what is happening here is in order to prevent a large amount of liquid going out, you put the channels into the membrane. So the water now can be reclaimed by the body. As we will explain, there is a high concentration of salt out here. There's a lot of salt out here. And so as a result, if you open these channels, water will fall down its osmotic gradient into the salt. But the trick is you have to have channels on both sides for the water to get all the way across. So this is with ADH. If there's no ADH, you have diuresis, meaning a lot of liquid. So what happens is the water comes in, but it can't get into the cell, it can't be saved, and the liquid goes out. So you have a higher volume of, more volume of urine. Now, as we've mentioned before, the whole point of this, of course, both with aldosterone and with ADH, is not that we care about salt or that we care about volume of urine in the urine. What we care about is the composition of the body fluids and the blood pressure. And it's to maintain that that ADH and aldosterone are secreted as appropriate. Now, you've all heard of diabetes. In diabetes, you have too much urine. But there's actually two kinds of diabetes. Diabetes mellitus and diabetes insipidus. Now, mellitus means sweet. This is ordinary what we think of as sugar diabetes or regular diabetes. You have too much sugar in the urine. That retains too much water, and there's too much volume. But in diabetes insipidus, the problem has nothing to do with sugar. The problem is ADH. You don't have ADH or enough ADH. So if there's no ADH, what happens to liquid? What comes in goes out. You have a huge volume of urine. And you can't control how much is excreted, and you have to continually drink water. In fact, what you do is you take ADH. Now, remember, ADH is also vasopressin. If you don't have enough water in your system, you constrict your blood vessels so that the liquid has less volume to fill, and you retain more liquid, so there's more to fill up the system. So between the two of them, you retain blood pressure, and you also, taking in liquid dilutes if you have too much salt. Again, I think at the end of this, if we have time, we will explain that the production of ADH is triggered primarily by high osmotic conditions in the blood. Too much dissolved solute in the blood causes you to make ADH, retain liquid, and dilute all that stuff. That's the primary trigger. Okay, so this is what ADH does and how it works. And in the absence of ADH, what's going to happen? It's going to be like with GLUT4 and insulin. In the absence of insulin, you remove the GLUT4 back into vesicles. In the absence of ADH, you do endocytosis and remove these water channels and put them back into vesicles where they don't work. How do you tell the two types of diabetes apart? Well, in the good old days, they tasted the urine. We should call it the bad old days, I suppose. Nowadays, they have dipsticks, but that's what they used to do. You don't have to do that anymore. Don't worry. Okay. Now, before we leave this, where are the receptors for ADH? Well, the channels controlled by ADH are on this surface, right? But where are the receptors for the hormone? Where are hormones? They're in the blood, circulating. Where are the capillaries? The capillaries are out here. So if the hormone is going to come in from the blood, well, ADH is a peptide. Where is its receptor, internal or external, on the surface? It's going to be on the surface. So which surface is it going to be on? It's actually going to be here, is where the ADH receptor is. Where is the aldosterone receptor? Aldosterone is a steroid. So where is the aldosterone receptor? If it acts on the same cells, there's some overlap, it'll be inside, intracellular. So I have only one more question. Which probably acts faster, ADH or aldosterone? ADH. Because it binds to a surface receptor, it triggers a signaling pathway, but aldosterone has to trigger transcription. Okay. Now, we've talked about these four processes from the sense of what does each process do. And we've talked about a generalized section of tubule. But now what we really want to do is look a little more closely at the anatomy of what does the tubule look like? It's not the same in every part. So that's diagrammed on the other side of your handout. Where there are three pictures representing sort of three different views of the setup. This time we're going to talk about the processes again, but sort of where along the line do they occur? Now, over on the left, we have a sort of picture of a whole kidney here. A sort of cross-section. Just like the medulla and many other structures, there's an inner part that looks different from the outer part. So the outer part is called the cortex, and the middle part is called the core is called the medulla. But that was the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla. This is the kidney medulla and the kidney cortex. Now, Remember we said there are these tubules. Each individual tubule is coiled up into a structure called a nephron. And one of them is drawn right here, sort of what it looks like. And they are packed together. And this is a sort of package of nephrons. And it's called a renal pyramid. Now, the tubules are coiled so that their tops stick into the cortex and their bottom is in the medulla. And they are all connected to the ureter, the ends of all the tubules, so they all feed into the same thing. So the renal pyramid represents the bottom of a whole bunch of nephrons. But the top is in the cortex. Now, what we've done on the right is to pick up one nephron and to show you how the tubule goes in one nephron. So that picture looks like this. Now, you have to remember this line is a tubule. It's a hollow tube. We're just trying to get the parts straight. And filtration occurs right here. This is that cup-shaped part at the beginning. And this is usually called Bowman's capsule. And this set of capillaries is going to be in here. It pays, in a way, to draw the capillaries in a slightly different way. Instead of drawing them this way, you can think of them as sort of going like this. So the first set are glomerular capillaries are inside Bowman's capsule and provide the filtration. And the second set, the peritubular, surround that loop and the rest of the tubule. So if I were to put them on the picture, they would look something like more like that. So these would be the peritubular capillaries. This would be the glomerular capillaries. Now, what's this? This is the afferent arteriole. And this is the efferent arteriole. This is being named from the point of view of the glomerulus, who comes in and who goes out. Now, the reason for distinguishing these, which is important, is that flow through the kidney is regulated because you have to have a certain level of flow in order to wash through the kidney properly and have enough oomph to wash out toxins, to pick up what is secreted and to allow reabsorption of what needs to be. So the flow through the kidney has to be kept at a fairly reasonable level. And one way it is controlled is by adjusting the relative sizes of these two tubules, these two arterioles. That if you dilate the afferent, or if you constrict the efferent, you increase the push through the filtration, through the glomerulus, into the kidney tubule. Now, you notice the way the liquid goes. In the loop, it goes down this side and up that side. But you'll see that in the bottom, where we've shown the picture as the tube as a tube, we have untwisted it to make life a little easier. Now, there's one more thing. This is called the loop of Henle. And there's one other thing, other things you have to see here. Now, these two parts are parts of the tubule, and they're obviously folded up, so they're called the proximal convoluted tubule and the distal convoluted tubule, or just proximal and distal. Remember, proximal is close, distal is far. So relative to the glomerulus or the loop, the proximal one comes first and the distal afterwards. most of the secretion and reabsorption, but not all of it, occurs in the proximal. Okay. So in terms of our previous picture, so the part here above the dotted line, the tubules on the top, the convoluted tubules, would be in the cortex, and the loop of Henle would be in the medulla. Now, there's one other piece here. What we've said is that liquid, through glomerular filtration, enters the tubule, enters the proximal tubule. Then it goes through the loop of Henle, as we'll explain, that adjusts salt and water. And then it goes through the distal tubule. And then what's this thing at the end? This is the collecting duct, which will feed into the ureter. And you notice it has multiple branches in this picture because multiple nephrons connect to the same collecting duct. So several different tubules are feeding into the same collecting duct. Now, just to match this picture, aldosterone works primarily on the distal tubule, and ADH primarily on the collecting duct. So they work on the end. Now, this is sort of the setup. And now we want to sort of think about what's happening where. And before we get into the details, it's probably worth summarizing what happens where. We've sort of said it a couple of times, but let's draw it. So if you look, just the crude bottom picture looks sort of like this. So material is coming in through the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. It's entering the tubule. So this is where the filtration is. That was process one. And now, most of the reabsorption of things like glucose and amino acids, that happens here. And most of the, a lot of the secretion happens here as well. Then, notice I've untwisted the loop of Henle. People talk about the descending loop and the ascending loop. And in this picture, you descend first. But in the real tubule, remember, it's twisted. So in the descending tubule, mostly you lose water, leaving the salt behind. So that by the time you get to the bottom, things are pretty concentrated. On the other hand, on the way back up, you primarily lose salt. We'll just say sodium because chloride follows. It's sodium that is pumped. And then the hormones take care of things at the end. So the adjustment of the water volume occurs at the very end. Now, most secretion occurs here in the proximal, but some of it occurs in the distal. Now, this may seem a little silly, because if you take water out and you concentrate the urine, and then you take the salt out, when you get back, it's dilute all over again. So why did you bother? Well, the primary answer is the volume is much less. Even if you're the same concentration you were when you started, there's a lot less of it. The other argument is actually by the time the fluid filtrate reaches the top here, it's actually at pretty dilute. It is at minimum osmolarity. You may notice that these things are measured in osmolarity. Osmolarity is a measure of the number of dissolved particles, the number of moles of dissolved particles. And it's maximal at the bottom of the loop of Henle, and it's minimal when you get up to the top. Now, the argument there is, by starting out with very dilute fluid, depending on what the ADH does, you can either leave it dilute, make it medium, or make it concentrated. You can't dilute it anymore, but you can concentrate it by removing water with ADH. And so by starting with dilute, you have your choice of how it comes out. So that's the basic idea here. Now, as your picture, I think, doesn't have any cells in it. But of course, it's important to realize that there are cells here all the way up and down lining it. And as we have said, almost all of them have a sodium-potassium pump on the backside. And what varies is the transporters on the luminal or the apical side. They are different in different parts of the tubule. So let's just think for a minute. If you're going to reabsorb glucose, and in a normal person, all the glucose is reabsorbed, what is that going to take? This is going to be exactly like the cells of the GI, except I drew it sideways. You're going to need active transport, co-transport with sodium to get into the cell, and then passive transport, facilitated diffusion, out the other side. And then there into the diffusion into the capillary. So in terms of proteins, there's a glute protein here and a sodium glucose co-transporter. Which is which? Where is the glute protein? Remember, glute means a transport, a passive transport down the gradient. So that's going to be over here. And then over here, you're going to have a sodium glucose co-transporter, or an SGLT protein. Now, because amino acids, sugars, etc. are co-transported with sodium, it means that a good deal of the sodium in the blood is actually retained as a result of this co-transport. More of it will be pumped out over here on the ascending, and a little bit more may or may not be removed courtesy of aldosterone. But a good hunk of it is removed just in co-transport. Now, we've already mentioned that there is actually a gradient of salt on the outside here. So in the medulla of the kidney, as you go down, there is more and more salt. So the salt gradient gets higher as you go down. Now, that is what pulls water out of the cells as you go down the descending. The descending, the cells, the membranes there, are not permeable to sodium, but they are to water. They have the transporters for water, but not for sodium. So the sodium is left in the filtrate. It can't get out. But why does the water leave? Because there's high sodium out here, high osmotic pressure. Water is pulled out to dilute the sodium. So water leaves these cells. Remember, water goes into the cell and out of the cell. So water travels down its gradient into the medulla. In the ascending, and it has several parts which have different structures if you read more advanced books, but we're ignoring that. There's a part of it which has all those sodium transporters that we talked about. So that sodium is pumped out. Sodium is pumped out the back of the cell, pulled in channels in the front, and goes into the interstitial fluid and into the blood. So sodium is removed actively, and these membranes are impermeable to water. So the water is left behind and the sodium pushed out actively. Now you notice, how does the water get out here? Active or passive?
Passive.
It's passive. How does the sodium get out here? Active or passive? I say it's a combination, but there's an active energy-using process in there or it won't work. And so when you get back up to here, most of the water and most of the salt are gone, and the stuff is fairly dilute, and now, depending on aldosterone, you may or may not remove a little more salt, and then ADH determines whether that water is, some of the water is kept, or whether it's all lost. Now, there are several things people talk about here. One, people talk about the escalator effect. If a little bit of sodium, so how did the sodium gradient get there? Because you keep taking out sodium here, there is a pump. And the pump can establish a gradient across here of about 200 milliosmoles. So however much sodium there is here, there will be more outside. But the more sodium there is outside, the more water gets pulled out when you come down. And so the more sodium there is to start with, so the higher there is pumped. That's actually called the multiplier effect. The so-called escalator effect is that if a little sodium comes out and diffuses in, it'll get carried around and pumped out, like an escalator. Okay. Now, this is the basic setup in the kidney. And we've already discussed what aldosterone and ADH do. Aldosterone is... Where is aldosterone made? Where does it come from? It actually comes from the adrenal cortex. You may remember we drew the adrenal cortex once before. Whoops, that was wet. That won't work. The adrenal, like the kidney, has an inner part and an outer part. And the medulla is controlled by the sympathetic nervous system and causes the release of norepinephrine. But the cortex is what produces cortisol in response to the appropriate tropic hormone, ACTH. Now, the cortex makes the steroid cortisol, but it also makes the steroid aldosterone. But it is not ACTH that is primarily in control of aldosterone. The production of aldosterone is not under control primarily of the HTAP axis, but of events in the kidney. So we've already explained that if flow through the kidney isn't fast enough, adjusting the sizes of the two arterioles can push more flow through the kidney. And if that's not sufficient, then additional factors trigger the production of aldosterone. And aldosterone causes more sodium to be recovered, therefore more water, thereby increasing the blood pressure and the blood volume. Now we know about ADH. ADH is released by the posterior pituitary, but made in the hypothalamus. And what would cause you to make ADH? You make ADH when you have to retain water. Why would you want to retain water? Well, either because of low blood pressure or because the osmolarity, the concentration of salt and stuff in your blood, was too high. So low blood pressure or high osmolarity. It turns out the primary trigger is actually the osmolarity, and there are sensors for that in the hypothalamus. You have to have very low blood pressure to kick in the production of ADH. It's a sort of fail-safe because, as we've mentioned, it constricts your peripheral blood vessels and it causes you to take in more water. So this is the primary one and the secondary. Now let me ask if there are any questions putting this together. Yeah.
Do you mind explaining the escalator and multiplier effect?
The escalator and multiplier. The escalator is the idea that if a little salt should diffuse, there's a high salt out here, and if a little salt should diffuse into the tubule, it will be carried around again and pumped out. So it will take a trip on the escalator. The multiplier effect is that sodium is pumped out, creating a gradient. That pulls out water, creating more salt in the tubule. When that salt comes around, more of it is pumped out, creating more gradient, etc. Now, if you look in more advanced textbooks, they will have actual numbers, and some of the animations show you what would happen if you started out with no gradient, and you did a little pumping, And then you move to the next period, and the next period, and the next period. So we're going to stop here, and I have all of the exams to return. If you don't want to wait, you can pick them up after the evening, I'd say tomorrow morning, in the boxes outside my office.
Which one's the moving section?
It's on the top. They're all both in that box. If there are any TAs here, I'd appreciate your assistance.
Section, no?
I think that's the morning.
That's the morning?
Yeah.
Okay. So there we go. All right. You take care of your side.
Here. You divide them. Give Justin a pile, too.
Okay. I've given you actually a big pile. Is that okay?
Okay.
So it's... Can I tell you?
I want to make an announcement. Some of you are going to be very happy, and some of you are going to be very upset. These exams are in reverse alphabetical order. So happy Z's. Okay? So just...
Morning Q through Z.
He has the end of the alphabet for the morning.
So H through P I have over here.
And I have from G back to A. After we finish this, we will do the evening section if you want to wait. I'm starting with G. Oh, Chris is here.
Yes.
I think Justin has a very big one.
A big one?
Mm-hmm. Ah, another person. Good. Well, okay, so Leia has C back through A. And I have G through D. Gujarati, Gujanti, Green, Gordon,
Sarah.
Is that you? Goodman, Gallagher, Gebremarian, Georgiakis. These are all the morning ones. We'll do the evening ones in a minute. What's your last name?
Green.
John Palmer?
Thank you.
Okay. Gamash? Garcia? GAO? Gabor? Figuera? Fife? Evroni? Eaton? Esau? Edwards, Duenas, Del Canto, DeWitt, Del Pratt, Dasani, Das, Daniel. Okay, so I have G through D in the morning. Anybody didn't get them?
Thanks.
Morning class? How do you... Oh, Rid Kama? Ahima. I had a Gabor before, but I think you're not related. Anybody else in the morning? G through D? And this is the evening. Justin has the evening, which is both the F and the second section. He has U through, he has Z, not at the moment, Z through R. Evening, Z through R.
Who has R for the morning?
Did you ask Chris? R through the morning? Yeah. No, it's not here. Are you sure? Where did you put it for the morning? This is Q?
Q through Z.
All I have is Q through Z for the morning.
Yeah, can I have R?
It doesn't have R. Dr. Heitland has R. I'm sorry, but I think they're in the... Dr. Heitland has it, I think.
Yeah.
She's over there. R in the morning? I think she has it.
W in the morning?
Yes. What's your last name?
Wu, W-U. First name is Y-I-K-E-N.
I have more than one Wu. Yeah. Okay. So, so Leia has M through P in the evening. M through P. Evening? I have H through L in the evening. Is that you? What's your last name? That's right. You sent me the email.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. I mean, I got really got wrong.
I think you got about half. I think that's the way they did. I looked at it. It seemed about right to me.
It seems like I got 77 to 78 on the previous one, so it doesn't, like, you know, it's not like a big drop right now.
Any more H through L in the evening? I'm not so good backwards.
Right. I think
it's here. Samantha?
Leader handler, Margo. LED.
Yeah, you're in here somewhere. Yeah, here you are, Margo.
Hillen Brand? H-I-L-L.
Keep going the wrong way.
H-A-N-E-Y. Don't see yours. It should be in here, but they're not in perfect order.
Is it only one section or something?
This is the evening. It should be in. This is the evening. Are you in the evening?
Oh, no. Okay. Oh, the agent's on
first.
Haney?
Yes.
These are all morning.
These are all morning.
No, this isn't it.
That's morning.
I know. That's morning.
That's
morning. No. I don't see it. I think Dr. Heitland has it. Yeah. H through L, L in the evening?
So we've done all the mornings?
I think so. There was one more person there who was looking for it.
So should we start evenings?
Yeah, we're doing that now.
So you're doing that.
But these are more... you just look them, off.
Done that I could help with?
Yes.
Anyone else for Q3?
So those are mornings or not?
No, these are evening. You can do... These are morning. These are morning. These are evenings.
Hi, Miri.
Do we have any evenings that are D to G?
Morning.
Oh, we did mornings. What do you need?
I'm H and S.
So H, you are with me.
S of
morning?
S of morning.
Megan?
Thank you.
Can you smell it?
H-E-R-B.
I can't do it backwards anyway. I'm no good at this.
Tell me the name.
Herbstman?
Thanks a lot.
Kretschmar, K-R-E-T.
I saw yours before. No, it's the other way. Not good backwards. I think we're okay.
There are people still waiting, just figuring out what they need. Has this been done yet, Dr. Office? This part?
No, I don't think so. It's just be sure it's evening.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah?
Kleiman.
What?
Kleiman. Kleiman Moran.
You're right here. Have you taken the keys?
Thank you.
Hi. Sam Kiernan, K-I-E-R.
What are you guys looking for?
Thank you very much.
What? Oh, he has A. Yes.
You don't I have A, H, L through H. Evening. L through H, evening.
Yeah, so B is good. B-A, B? Oh, so what is the name? Oh, Barbara.
got it? Yeah, I'll get yours.
I'm right, Bianca.
I guess Barish, T-A-R-A.
Thank you.
This is New York.
Barnes.
I don't have any.
Michelle, John. John, Barnes.
What do you need?
Natalie.
Evening.
From the morning or the evening?
Anybody? Evening, H through L?
This is not. You said matter?
You thought it
was.
No.
Michael?
Yeah.
The evening or the morning?
Evening.
Anybody from U through Z in the evening? Wang?
Wang.
You didn't look like a Wang, but you never know. No, it's not in here. I thought it. Wait a minute. It should be in here. Wait a minute. Here it is. Benjamin?
Yeah.
Caitlin?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, good morning or the evening?
What's your name?
Kazlo. Okay, let's see.
Fine.
Oh, I forgot to turn this on.